I have preached a bunch of Easter sermons over the years where I've told some of my favorite stories. Crazy stories like the coon hunter that Billy Graham knew who fell into a freshly cut grave on a rainy night. And try though he may, it was too slippery, the walls were too muddy, he could not climb out. So he sat down in the corner to wait for help. Later that same night, a drunk stumbling through the cemetery fell into the same hole. And try as he might, the drunk man could not scale the muddy walls either, until he felt a hand on his shoulder and heard a voice from behind him say, "You can't get out of here." But he did. Stories like the guy was walking home late past the cemetery. He hears something behind him. It sounds like something bumping on the road. He looks back. It seems to be something in the shape of a casket. So he speeds up. So does the noise behind him. He starts to run for his house. The thudding keeps coming until he gets into the house and he closes the door and he thinks he's safe, but the casket crashes through the door. So he runs upstairs and he hides in his bathroom, but the casket follows him into the bathroom. In fear, the man grabs whatever's within reach and he throws it at the approaching box. And when he hits it with a bottle of Robitussin, it stops. It stops moving. It stands still. You know why? Because Robitussin stops the coffin. I have told moving stories on Easter, like the mentally challenged boy who brought an empty egg to a classroom to symbolize new life. And when his teacher asked him what that was about, he said, "Well, the tomb was empty too, Miss Miller." And then the boy died a few weeks later, and all of his classmates placed their empty eggs on his grave. I've told such stories a lot, and now I've told them again. I was asked several times this week what I was going to preach about today. One person asked me if I was going to preach my normal Easter sermon, or did I have something interesting to say this year? And I said, well, first of all, I have to talk twice at the Good Friday gathering. Once I get through that, I'm hoping I will be able to figure out what to say for Sunday. And it was good. Friday, several churches getting together to remember the cross of Jesus, that was good. But what I realized as the five different guys talked about Jesus' cross that night was that every one of us finished our thoughts by pointing ahead to the resurrection. Like, the cross is good, what happens there matters a lot, but if that's where the story ends, the story doesn't really have a good ending. So that's when I decided that what I should do today is to tell some stories about what happened after the cross, so that that's not the end of the story. And as I read the four records that the people alive right then wrote about what happened afterwards, I noticed something. Those guys put a lot of detail into this. It's like they piled on the evidence for Jesus' risenness. Which is weird, because mostly Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John don't bother to ever defend the miracles. They don't defend him at all. He turned water into wine, period. He made a paralyzed man who had never walked walk, period. He fed 5,000 people and their kids, period. He walked on the water, period. No proof, no defense. They just say Jesus did that. I imagine there were enough witnesses around that could still verify all that. But when it comes to Jesus being alive again, these guys slow down and add evidence. Like Matthew, who said, the two Marys went to the tomb. There was a violent earthquake because an angel rolled the stone away from the tomb's entrance, and then he sat on it, scaring the guards half to death, daring them to try to put the stone back in place. Then the angels led the ladies on a tour of the empty grave. And then they passed on some GPS coordinates to where Jesus wanted to meet the guys. And Jesus appeared to the ladies as they ran back to town just to say hi. And they worshiped him. That's how Matthew tells the story. Mark adds that Salome was there. Salome was part of the ladies' group that morning. They were bringing spices to finish the embalming process that Joseph and Nicodemus had begun. And Mark includes some of their discussion on the way. On the way, the ladies realized, oh, we're not going to be able to get in. There's a really big rock in the way. My parents got to travel to Israel once, and they were shown tombs like the one that Joseph owned, like the one Jesus was put in. And the stones, the huge, flat, round stones that blocked the entrance. And they had cut tracks in front of each tomb, V-shaped, The tomb's opening was at the bottom of the V, so one soldier could close the tomb by himself, just push it enough that it would roll downhill into the V. But it would take lots and lots and lots of strong people to push that giant stone up out of the V. But sure enough, Mark's report confirms, a very large stone had been rolled away. And the angel that met the lady said, "Jesus, he's out of here. Yep, alive. Go tell his guys and tell Peter he's coming." And the ladies, who are the only ones in the world who know this right now, fled, scared half to death. There was lots of half scared to death that morning. John says Mary, when it was still dark, because she couldn't wait to be with Jesus, dead though he may be. John says Mary went to the tomb and saw the stone on the ground, and she ran back to tell Peter and me that his body had been stolen. John says, so Peter and I ran to the tomb. I naturally got there first because I'm faster. Once I got there, we saw, wow, Mary's right, Jesus isn't here. And he said, it's weird. The mummy strips that wrapped around his dead body were still there. And the face towel that had been over him was folded up neatly in the corner. And then Mary went back to the tomb later, and the angels that she met there asked why she was crying, and she said, well, his body's gone. And then Jesus walked up behind Mary and asked why she was crying, and she said, I just want to find him. And he said, Mary. And she recognized his voice, and she turned around and recognized him, and she screamed. And for the first time that morning, she is not scared half to death. She is thrilled to death that he wasn't dead. And she ran back and she told everybody who she'd just seen and talked to, and they didn't believe her. Women can be so emotional, you know, which is why women's testimony didn't count. Weird, all these accounts have women being the first witnesses of Jesus being alive, which is a really bad plan on Jesus's part if he's going to go along with the typical Jewish narrative of the day that a woman is the most unreliable witness of all witnesses. But then John says, so that night we were all together locked in to keep the Jewish police out, and Jesus pops in. I mean, literally pops in just to say hello. And we saw him and we touched him and we ate with, well, that's in Luke, but they ate with him. Jesus showed up and he asked for something to eat, and they said, what? And they gave him a fish sandwich, which he ate. Jesus ate a fish, which makes me happy because I love fish sandwiches. Like at Paella Fish Market or Coconuts or Eskimo Candy or one of the, I digress. We're looking at the proof that they were piling up, like Thomas. Thomas, who wasn't there that first Sunday night when Jesus came back, he was not there with all of the other guys. And this is where I'm contractually obligated to remind you that all of the best stuff happens in church gatherings that you, for some reason, don't go to. I mean, Thomas didn't get to see Jesus alive because he wasn't there that night. Why didn't he go? I don't know, but he wishes he went. How does Thomas's unbelief that Jesus really did come back to life prove that Jesus really did come back to life? That's just it. His own guys don't believe this story at first. They too are skeptical. They're not making up some unbelievable story. They didn't believe the story until they did. Like the next Saturday night, you bet Thomas was there. Absolutely, he was there. Not going to miss anything happening in that Sunday night. The doors are still locked. It's a week later. Jesus pops in, literally just pops in, appears in their midst. And you know the first thing Jesus said when he got there? I'm guessing. He probably said, Thomas, what's up? Oh, wait, I am. But it wasn't just in a smoke-filled room with barred doors that Jesus appeared. John tells how they met Jesus out on the beach when they were fishing in the open air. They're walking outside. Later, we find out at one point that the alive again Jesus appeared to 500 people at once. 500 people? Like, what do you call it when you get 1,000 people from Indiana together, but half of them are insomniacs? 1,000 people from Indiana, half can't sleep. You call them the Indianapolis 500. Indianapolis 500. Should I spell it for you? Indianapolis. It is rare for 500 people to all have the same dream at the same time, the same hallucination at the same time. That doesn't happen. 500 people saw Jesus alive at once. And there's one more evidential story. Luke records this one on the last page of his gospel about the two guys who were walking home on the Sunday after it occurred. on Friday, the crucifixion, on that Sunday, these two guys are walking down the road, and they are talking about how sad it was that Jesus just got executed. All the stuff that Cheryl read for us, they had seen all that happen. And Jesus joins them as they walk down the road. But they don't recognize him, and you can't really blame them. After all, he was dead. And no matter how similar a person may be in appearance, if you see someone at Wegmans who looks like somebody you buried 2 days ago, you know it's not that person. That's what burial means, no more seeing them. So these guys are hiking the 7-mile trip home from Jerusalem when a man joins them along the way, just walking along. And the only thing they know for sure about this guy is that he's not Jesus, because Jesus is dead, which is why they're going home, because Jesus is dead. They're so sad. They are so depressed. They almost despair of life. I read about a guy in Buffalo who despaired of life. He was so sad, he jumped out his fourth floor window. But unfortunately for him, he landed on a car roof, and he only suffered facial cuts, which made him mad. So he went back upstairs, went back to the fourth floor, same window, jumped again, landed on the same car roof. This time he broke his arm, and he's really sad. The police arrested him and took him to a Buffalo hospital, the report said, where he was admitted and given a first floor room. These two guys are very sad. They are so disappointed. They're lost. And Jesus joins them. And when he asked what they're talking about, they said, "Are you kidding? We're talking about what everybody's talking about." And Jesus says, "Which is what?" And these two guys start telling Jesus about Jesus. He was a guy. He was sent from heaven. He was a great speaker. He did the most amazing stuff. He was loved by everybody. Well, not everybody. The preachers didn't like him, so they killed him last Friday, which makes us sad. And the other guy said, "And what's really crazy is some of the ladies we know said somebody stole his body." Well, maybe. They said that the angels told them that Jesus is alive, but you know how ladies are. So I was reading through some top 10 quotes this week from caddies of bad golfers. Top 10 quotes of caddies of bad golfers. And there were some good ones, like the golfer who said, "Do you think I can reach the green with a 5-iron? And the caddy said, "Eventually." The golfer was playing badly. He said, "I am so bad today. I'm just going to go drown myself in the lake." Caddy said, "Never happen. You can't keep your head down." But my favorite, the golfer who said, "You have got to be the worst caddy in America." And the caddy said, "Oh, I don't think so. That would be too much of a coincidence." Talk about coincidence. The guy who they say is missing is walking right there next to them, but they don't see it. Which is one of the basic ideas of this church. We think Jesus is really here, trying to break onto the radar screens of our lives. And until he does, we'll never find the satisfaction we long for. Something will always be missing until we recognize him. More about that in a minute. These two guys are walking along. It's so sad that Jesus had to die. And then Jesus says, "Oh, you dunderheads. You guys are so dense." Well, those are not the exact words that he used, but that's kind of how he felt. In Luke chapter 24, verse 25, Jesus said to them, "How foolish you are. And how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?" And the two guys say, "Dude, what are you talking about? The Messiah has to die? What does that mean? What?" Verse 27, "And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, Jesus explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." Jesus went all the way back to Genesis, and he worked his way through all 39 books of the Old Testament, showing God, forecasting the Messiah's pain, the Messiah's suffering, that he'd be mocked, he'd be beaten, he'd be lied about, he'd be railroaded, he'd be stripped, abandoned, betrayed, he'd be executed, he would be buried, he would be dead. He would be gone, the Messiah would be gone. But then he would be alive again. It's in the Old Testament. And Jesus knew all these scriptures because from the time he was little, his mom had studied these scriptures with him. Wouldn't you, if God told you that your miraculously conceived child was going to be Messiah, wouldn't you help him as he's growing up learn every Messiah passage there is in the Bible? And that's what Jesus explained to those two guys as they walked. and they arrived at home before they knew it. Sometimes I drive to Buffalo, and I'll listen to a sermon as I drive, and if the sermon's really good, I'm there before I know it. They got home. They got to Emmaus, but they didn't want Jesus to stop talking because he was so fascinating, so they invited him in for dinner, hoping that he would keep on explaining the Bible to them. One of the coolest things in the world is to have somebody who understands the Bible well and how it applies to real life explain it to you in a way that you can understand. My brother and I listened to a great preacher at Mountain View Christian Camp one time. The guy preached that night for 50 minutes. It seemed like 5 minutes. And as we left the chapel, my brother said, "When Tom reads the Bible, he sees things in there I don't see." And then he said, "But if I could see Scripture the way he sees it, I would read my Bible all the time." Jesus was unpacking the Bible, and these guys were just eating it up. One golfer said, "I would move heaven and earth to break 100 on this course." The caddy said, "Try heaven. You've already moved most of the earth." One golfer asked his caddy, "How do you like my game?" And the caddy said, "Very good, sir. But personally, I prefer golf." Somebody said, "Golf is basically the adult version of an Easter egg hunt." One of our church's basic ideas is that the Bible is filled with good stuff. It is a fascinating book. Some of it's hard. It has to be studied. But when you understand it and when you apply it to how you live, if you will look for it, if you will hunt for the stuff in there, the Bible is more like magic than anything else on earth. And that's what these two guys were thinking while Jesus was explaining the Bible to them. But then the trip is over, and it looks like Jesus is going to keep going, so they beg him, please stay, eat with us. And Jesus agreed. I love this story. Verse 30 says, when Jesus was at the table with them, he went into their house. When he was at the table with them, he took the bread, he gave thanks, he broke it, and he began to give it to them. Isn't that weird? They invite him into their home as a guest, and he immediately acts as the host. It is a habit of his. If you invite him in, he will take over. More about that in a minute. He gave thanks for the food. Every time we see Jesus eating the Bible, he thanks his Father for the food first. And then he starts to pass it out. He starts to hand them bread. And Luke says in verse 31, then their eyes were opened. They recognized him. He disappeared from their sight. And they asked each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? Can you imagine these guys, totally depressed, long, sad walk home, a stranger joins them, starts explaining the Bible better than they've ever heard anybody explain it. They invite him in for supper. They sit down at the table. Somehow, they realize while they're sitting there, holy cow, it's Jesus. And he's clearly not dead. Not at all. He's not dead. Oh my goodness, he's alive. He's sitting right here. Whoa. I think when Jesus handed them the bread, they saw his torn up wrists. And the hair on the back of their necks stood up, and they looked up at his face, and they gasped. At which point, I think Jesus smiled and disappeared. Think Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland. Just disappeared. But read the words carefully. Luke wrote what he meant. Jesus vanished from their sight, which he would do a lot over the next 40 days. Appear, disappear, suddenly there, suddenly gone. But he wasn't really gone. He was just not visible to their sight. There's a big difference. And Jesus was preparing his guys for the day when he would stop appearing, but he'd still be there with them, like he is still here. Sitting at the table, they realized it was Jesus, and they immediately went back 7 miles to Jerusalem, running probably as much as they could, back towards Jerusalem, because they had news. And when they got there, they told the guys in the room, "The ladies are right. He is alive." And while they were talking, guess who shows up? Right there in front of them. Oh, yes, he did. Quite a busy schedule Jesus kept that first Sunday. But I mean, he'd been dead a couple days. There was lots to catch up on. There's lots of evidence. The disciples pile up the proofs in the pages they recorded. Jesus is alive again. But what's it prove? What do we get out of what they say happened? What happens in our lives because of what happened in his life? Three things, and I'll go very quickly. Hang in there. Number one, Jesus is alive again, so we can know for sure death is not the end. Is there life after death? Yep. How do you know? Because Jesus came back from the dead. It's like asking, do you think anybody will ever get to the moon? I mean, it's a long way up there. There's no air. There are no roads. And you say, come on, Walker, get with it. It's already been done. We've already been there. Okay, so let me ask you a question. Do you think that after we die, we can live again? Tell you what, already been done. He's been there, done that. Because Jesus lives, we can too. His resurrection proves there is still life to come. Number two, Jesus is alive again, so we can know what to do in the here and now. We can know how to live. He said that he knew how to live life in a way that would beat death. But then he died, and everyone, oh. But then he came back, and people said, whoa, it works. And those people who watched him said, his way really works. We recommend doing whatever he says. So when Jesus says, if you will try to save your life, if you try to save your life, you'll lose it. But if you'll give it away, you will win. Jesus says, so when people really, really hurt you, eat it and then do what's best for that person. Jesus said, rejoice always. Give thanks in all things. Encourage others. Jesus said, don't ever entertain a sexual thought about anyone you're not married to, ever. Jesus said, sell your possessions and give some money to those who have need. Jesus said, stop being so angry. Jesus said, obey your parents, honor your father and mother. Husbands, make every decision you ever make based on what's best for your wife. Jesus said, deny yourself, take captive every thought, love the people around you. Put me first, trust me most. Let me teach you how to do life. And we say, oh, Jesus, that's crazy. That's crazy talk. We can't do that. If we tried to do it like you say, it'd kill us for sure. And Jesus said, if you die, you die. No worries. I've got that covered. Just follow me. So what should you do in life? You should do the next thing you know Jesus wants you to do and trust him to bail you out. Number three, Jesus is alive again. And we can know him. He vanished from their sight, but he was still there with them. He appeared out of nowhere. He disappeared into nowhere for 40 days. He came and he went. Now you see him, now you don't. And he was showing them, and he was showing us, even though we can't always see him, he's always around. We have an invisible Lord who is always with us. And I don't mean to sound needlessly Osteen-esque, but Jesus' commands are not about guilt. Everything he tells us to do is an opportunity. It is possible for us to live better than we've ever lived before because the same power that shook him back to life can shake us free from whatever's messing us up. Jesus did not come back to die, did not die and come back so he could set up a new religion. He went through all of that so that we could be his friends again, all the time, no matter what you've done, no matter what you're doing right now. Jesus has the ability to step over any dysfunctionality you're dealing with right now. He can help you get healthy. He's so good, and he's alive. And because he is, people in this room have, with his help, stopped screaming in anger at their families. People in this room have stopped looking at porn. People in this room have given up grudges that they have held for years and been free. People have stopped living selfishly all the time. With his help, people in this room have seen dead marriages resurrect, trust rebuilt, siblings reconciled, generosity learned, addictions overcome, and families restored. He's done that for us, with us, in us. He can bring new life into our lives. If we will let him work with us, live in us, train us, we can be better. So, is this just another normal Easter sermon? Maybe. Or maybe you really do want to know how to stop the coffin. Maybe you do really want to be done with the scared to death of getting stuck in a grave. Maybe you would like your friends to leave your funeral someday with real hope about what's next for you. And I'm here to tell you, you can. If you will make the very much now alive Jesus the center of your story. Here's my last story. Billy Graham suffered from Parkinson's at the end of his life pretty severely. So when the leaders of a Charlotte Charlotte, North Carolina church invited him to a luncheon in his honor. He said no. But they insisted he really needed to come. He didn't need to say anything. He just needed to show up. So finally, Billy Graham agreed. At the lunch, after many wonderful things were said about him, he slowly climbed the stage steps, and he stood behind the podium, and he looked out, and he said, "I am reminded today of Albert Einstein, the great physicist, Time's man of the century." He said, "Einstein was once traveling from Princeton on a train when the conductor came through the aisle punching each passenger's ticket. When he got to Albert Einstein, Albert reached into his vest pocket, but he couldn't find his train ticket. So he reached into his pants pocket, but it was not there either. So he opened up his briefcase and started to look through. The conductor said, 'Dr. Einstein, I know who you are. We all know who you are. I'm sure you bought a ticket. Don't worry about it.' And he just went on. When he was done punching all the tickets on the train, the conductor came back through that car to find Albert Einstein down on his hands and knees looking under his seat for his train ticket. And the conductor rushed over and said, 'Dr. Einstein, don't worry about it. I know who you are. You don't need the ticket. I'm sure you bought one.' And Einstein looked up at him and said, 'Young man, I too know who I am. What I don't know is where I'm going.'" Billy Graham finished telling that story and then added, he said, "Do you see the suit I'm wearing today? It's brand new." He said, "My wife and my children and my grandchildren are telling me that I've gotten a little slovenly in my old age. I guess I used to be a little more fastidious. So I went out and I bought a new suit for this luncheon and for one other occasion." He said, "You know what that occasion is?" He said, "This is the suit that I will be buried in." And then Billy Graham said, "But when you hear that I'm dead, I don't want you to remember the suit I'm wearing. I want you to remember this. I not only know who I am, I also know where I'm going." You can know who you are and where you're going. It all comes into focus once you know the guy who was dead and is now alive and will happily pay your ticket.